This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. Pfizer saying the COVID-19 shot it's developed with BioNTech was 90.7% effective against symptomatic cases in kids ages 5 to 11. 7-day moving average of new cases has dropped 15% in the past week. That's good news.
Very good news. That's very good news. In Europe, Germany recorded its steepest one-day increase, though, in new coronavirus cases in more than 5 months. Meanwhile, a majority of Swiss are seen backing a law allowing the government to issue COVID-19 certificates for entry into theaters and restaurants ahead of a national vote.
All right, so let's get to it. Let's get our weekly check with Dr. Ian Lusbader,
clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone's Medical Center. He joins us now on the phone from New York City. Dr. Lusbader, happy Friday. It's good to have you back with us. The CDC backing boosters from J&J and Moderna. We're also learning that people can choose a shot that's different from their original one. Carol and I have been talking so much about
this. Help us.
Look, full disclosure, we're emailing each other about like, okay, what booster are we going to get? How are we going to do this? Help give us some guidance here.
Hopefully good. Happy Friday, guys. Definitely lots of news on all the fronts. Not safe to go to a party, it seems, without potential risk.
That's a good point.
So because Delta has arrived and mutated in the original Alpha vaccines, although pretty effective over time, have sort of waned. Obviously, there's been this whole debate and studies. But finally, the CDC has come out with recommendations. So certainly for the people who receive the Pfizer and Moderna two-shot regimen, if it's been 6 months after the second shot, you're eligible for a booster. Those are people 65 and older. Those are people 18 and older who have either underlying medical conditions or live or work in a high-risk setting like healthcare. You may consider your office a high-risk setting, possibly.
Yeah.
But officially, we're talking, first responders, healthcare providers, teachers in school, prison settings, manufacturing. There's really a very wide list. And there's a bit of a wide list of the underlying medical conditions. So basically, de facto, most people, if you're above 18, would be eligible after 6 months for a booster. And J&J, somewhat similar. That's a two-month window. That's 18 and older. That's about 15 million people who are eligible because they received the first shot. So, and the second shots really, or rather the third shots, can be mix and match. The data is having two different kinds of vaccines seems to really increase antibodies. So at this point, it's certainly reasonable to take a third vaccine of whatever the first two you've had. Although if that's not available, or for a variety of reasons you want to switch to another one, it's probably perfectly fine to do that.
Well, Ian, let's talk about that. Some are saying that there might be benefits to mixing and matching. Tell us what's your take or what is the advice that you guys are following so far when it comes to that. It sounds like they want to do mix and match so that you don't feel like if you've had Pfizer and all you can get access to is Moderna as a booster, to not walk away from it. But what should we understand about mix and match? Is it a good thing to do or it doesn't really matter?
It probably is actually a good thing to do. It exposes your immune system to a slightly different, sort of variant or vehicle. Certainly the people who got J&J, it does seem that getting a messenger RNA vaccine really boosts their immunity more vigorously. So if you had J&J and you want another J&J, you could certainly do that. But if you take any of the mRNAs, you certainly get a bigger boost out of that. And that also looks like for the Pfizer and Moderna, that if you do kind of switch those, it looks like you may get a bit of a boost too. What we don't really have is long-term data, right? So we do know these 90% improvements in protection certainly go out about the study length, which is about 15 to 29 days. So certainly for a while you're very protected, much decreased infection and transmissibility. We don't really know 6 months from now what that will be. We think it's going to be effective, and there's probably some T-cell and memory cell boost. Hopefully COVID will be winding down in the United States after the next 6 months, so it will give you some protection along the way. But also important to stay healthy, lose weight, control the diabetes, control your blood pressure, you know, take supplements like vitamin D if you're low. So there are other approaches, but in general, it would make sense to switch if you can, but there's no harm in taking the third of what you've already taken.
Okay, some very helpful information there. Hey, Dr. Lesbader, you said hopefully COVID will wind down over the next 6 months. What do you think it'll look like as it goes from pandemic to endemic?
You're exactly right. Endemic. I think we'll be having cases sporadically. We do have some data about vaccines for kids 5 to 11 as well. Again, those are small studies, 2,000 studies. You know, whether or not that will make a big difference in the endemic nature, we don't know. But I think hopefully we'll have either some treatments, and hopefully as resistance builds from a herd immunity point of view, there may be cases of COVID, and obviously if we have home test kits, that would be great. If you think you're sick and it turns out positive, please don't go to work. So I think we'll be able to live with this, and hopefully it will be even less damaging than the flu, which does have a mortality of about 50,000 per year.
Yeah. All right. Going to leave it on that note. Hey, Ian, have a great weekend. Dr. Ian Lesbader, clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center, on the phone from New York City. So what would you do then in a booster? Would you flip?
Yeah, I think I'd flip.
You'd flip?
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, I got Pfizer.
I know. Me too.
And Moderna's all the rage now with the Delta variant and breakthroughs.
Moderna's all the rage. I'm going to get T-shirts printed up. All right, you are listening to Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Once we start talking about this story, you're going to understand why it is the most read story on the Bloomberg today. And if you're looking for access to West Point generals, confidential support groups, and private getaways, Tim, we've got the place for you.
Yeah, you probably should be a billionaire, pretty close to a billionaire.
Well, maybe not. It's not a guarantee, Kev.
It's not a guarantee.
No.
You still won't not guaranteed to get in. To give us all the details is Suzanne Woolley, personal finance reporter at Bloomberg News. She's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. It's called R360. What
yes.
is it?
It's a very exclusive new membership organization for people who have at least $100 million in net worth, although the average of the 48 members right now is about $200 million. And it's this sort of mishmash of things. It's like a peer-to-peer learning network, but it's also an investment network. And it's sort of a taking a more holistic view of your wealth. And you go on this three-year journey, quote, air quotes, journey, that costs $180,000 for you and your family.
You know, that doesn't seem that expensive considering...
If you're worth a few hundred million dollars.
How much, yeah, because if you think about it from the perspective of, okay, well, how much are expensive
Suzanne's
country
like,
clubs?
Okay, Tim.
Well, I mean, how much... I mean, my mind, when I was reading this morning, my mind immediately
percentage
went to country
wise,
clubs, right?
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, and that's like, you know, they're country clubs that cost that much.
Yeah, well, you do pay more for if you want to go on, you know, the private trip to Richard Branson's Necker Island.
Which happened. Maybe play some tennis.
Play some tennis with Branson.
Hang out. Tell us about the individual, like who created this? What was the idea, the thinking, and how maybe it's kind of representative of our times, perhaps?
Yeah, it's interesting. A man named Charles Garcia started it. He's an entrepreneur and has been in a lot of different networks, including Tiger 21, which is a very well-known network. And he was at the Harvard Advanced Leadership Initiative, where you go for 10 months and you sort of create a project and develop it with a lot of the professors there. And he came up with this idea for R360 as a way to sort of get together a lot of like-minded people with a lot of wealth who can learn from each other. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the rich do have different problems than you and me.
But it's interesting, too, because is it just professional problems? Is it personal problems? It's 360, so I'm assuming it's everything.
It is. You know, they talk about having, like, six areas of capital that you're going to focus on over that three-year journey. So you have, it spells fishes, it's financial, intellectual, spiritual, human, emotional, did I say that already? And social.
Fishes.
Fishes. And so you sort of, you're trying to gain mastery over all these six areas. And you're doing that in workshops with, say, like, meetings of 15 of your like-minded peers.
Yeah.
None from the same company or, you know, industry, so that you can be very open. But it is. It's talking about, it could be work. It could be, a lot of the talk is about children. Mm. People who have come into wealth, a lot of these people are entrepreneurs,
right,
who sort of suddenly became wealthy, and they don't want their children to be corrupted.
One interesting thing about this was how this is set up as an entity, a limited partnership with partners contributing $350,000 each. But the idea is that it'll never be sold.
Yes.
And as you report, they want this to be around a century or two from now.
Right. They have very grand visions of what they hope to do with this group. It's 48 members, and they own, I guess, about 60% of R360. And it's sort of unique in being member-owned like that, and the members themselves are creating the programming, although they're also creating programming with a lot of elite universities, you know, Harvard, Stanford, MIT, special programs made just for their members.
Right.
But it's a unique structure.
Well, and I'm curious about, okay, if it is truly representative of our times. I mean, we've talked about how much wealth creation, but I think about diversity, inclusion. Like,
yes,
are they approaching it? I mean, if you really want to get smarter thought, most people would say you have to have diverse thought and inclusive,
yes,
thought.
That's true. I mean, I think it is indicative of our times, just because there is so much wealth, and the gaps between like the merely wealthy and the super wealthy are growing. And they do have a special focus, they say, on women. Women will get a massive wealth transfer in years from now.
Hmm.
So they have, there's a women's committee, there's a rising generation committee of young, you know, leaders.
Right.
I think they have a diversity of thought, but they're, you know, they're all very, very, very wealthy.
Yeah, there's still a commonality.
Yeah.
What about when it comes to access to deals or deal flow and actually having opportunities to get in on something?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. It's a big part of any network. You know, Tiger 21, there's a mm-hmm. lot of that there. And these are people who see a lot of deals, you know. So what they're doing is they're, you know, people can present deals, but they want to be very disciplined about it. So they put it through a very rigorous checklist. They, four of the members form an investment committee. And they go through a checklist of supposedly 100 different things. And then they send it out to an outside due diligence firm to look at sort of operationally, is it, you know, up to snuff, and financially. And then the member can propose a phone call, and any member who wants to can call in. But they have, like many places, they have a really an emphasis on non-solicitation, because people just hate being, I mean, you know, we'd love to get into some of these deals, right? But,
yeah,
you know, if you're very wealthy, you're bombarded with deals all the time.
Well, I also like to, you talked, I think, a little bit about generational wealth, right? And you can actually make, was it a film or a book about,
yeah,
like, that to me is interesting.
I think it's kind of cool. It, yeah, you could, they have a document, they have a full-time filmmaker on staff. And you get a documentary made. And the point is, you know, you want influence to be a good steward of capital, they say. You want to influence generations that are to come, that are benefit, that will benefit from your wealth, but that will never know you.
Right.
And they will never know where the money came from and the work that it took and how many people were involved. So it's partly, you know, a document to create your legacy, and mm-hmm. then you'll work on it over this three-year journey. And at the end of the journey, presumably, you will have a clear sense of your purpose in life and
yeah.
the good you want to do in the world, and you'll finish the
so
movie.
Perhaps somebody's listening right now. They're saying, I got a few $100 million. I'm interested in the fishes idea. How do I get in?
Sorry, you can't get in.
Oh.
Because we're done? Because they're done in terms of...
Well, no, they're not. You can get in, okay? But it's invitation only.
Oh.
So the 50 members that are there now, they can each invite two people. They only want to get 50 people a year.
How's it going to be diverse that way? No offense. Forgive me.
Yeah. Yeah. But so right now it's just...
When you did, we've just got about 25 seconds left, Suzanne. When you started working on the story, what is it that you really wanted to know about it?
I just wanted to know what they were going to learn from each
yeah,
other,
right.
You know, and what was the real demand. And it was interesting to hear a lot of it just being about children, which isn't really surprising, but
right.
a lot about
that
how do you protect your children from sort of being, I don't know, corrupted by...
My wealth. Yeah, right. We've seen it. There's certainly been lots of real-life stories of it. Great read. Most read story on the Bloomberg. Suzanne Woolley, thank you so much. She's personal finance reporter here at Bloomberg News in our Interactive Brokers studio.
I'll do it.
It's only 180 to pony out. Just saying.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, I mentioned Chipotle Mexican Grill. Stock's down about 3.2% today. Company reported earnings after the close last night. Sales last quarter topping analyst estimates. Chipotle benefited from price increases and digital ordering, along with vaccination efforts that really helped bring customers back into the stores. Let's get to it. Stock, by the way, up about 29% so far in 2021. Great to have back with us the chairman and CEO of Chipotle, Brian Niccol. He is joining us from Newport Beach, California. Brian, you know what we all want to know is, did you just have a smoked brisket sandwich? Because they seem to be so in demand.
Well, actually, I just had a smoked brisket quesadilla.
You did?
As a matter of fact,
We knew it, and we're jealous. We're going to talk about this. Listen, what I love about talking to you is you have been in the consumer space, the restaurant space, for a while. You were at Procter & Gamble for 10 years. You moved up the channel at Taco Bell, eventually becoming president and CEO. You really repositioned that company. You understand this space. What's it like to be a CEO in this space when you're still dealing with the pandemic? You're dealing with labor inflation, wage inflation, and commodity inflation. How tough is it? And how tough is this environment?
Well, look, you know, one thing that's I've learned early in my career and still stands today is you got to have a strong brand that stands for something in the consumer's mind to navigate all those headwinds that you just mentioned. And we're pretty fortunate. You know, Chipotle has always stood for food with integrity. And then when you peel that back, you know, we provide great culinary, tremendous customization, really, you know, I think world-class access. And then, you know, you roll that all together and we've got a really strong value proposition. So our brand has stayed really strong throughout all this. And we're really fortunate that, you know, we've got a brand that really resonates with consumers and resonates with our employees.
But if I had to ask you to characterize the environment, what word would you use, Brian? Is it tough?
Yeah, it's tough. You know, it's definitely tough. You got to make sure that, you know, you've got clear strategies. You have to make sure that everybody's executing on, you know, all cylinders. And I'm really proud of our team. You know, I think our results speak for our strategies and our execution and the caliber of the people that we have across our organization. And I don't think it's going to get any easier here going forward.
Well, Brian, you mentioned the power of the Chipotle brand. When it comes to how consumers think about it, how much pricing power do you have to actually pass along higher costs that you're experiencing, whether they're labor costs or commodity costs, onto consumers?
Yeah, you know, we look at that both in the past, right? We have had to take some price recently, and we were fortunate to have such a strong value proposition that we didn't really see any resistance from consumers. We continue to track closely what our value proposition looks like, and we continue to have a really strong value score with consumers. And you know, a lot of people ask me, well, what does that really mean? You know, the way I bring it to life, a chicken burrito or a chicken bowl, which is the number one thing we sell, it's still less than $8. And so when you stop and think about the, you know, the culinary, the quality of those ingredients, the customization of the meal for less than $8, you're hard pressed to find that anywhere else. And that is what we mean by, hey, we've got a tremendous value proposition and we still have lots of pricing power moving forward. So, you know, as I've said many times before, it's really the last thing we like to pull. We prefer, you know, get the growth, find ways to cut costs, to really be efficient. But if we need to use the pricing lever, we do it. We've done it in the past. We're pretty judicious with it. And fortunately, we've navigated it really well.
Well, given the challenging environment that you described to us, when realistically could you see yourselves raising prices again?
You know, it's something that we're looking at right now. We traditionally always evaluate near the end of the year, what do we think inflation is going to look like for, you know, wages and a lot of our other input costs. So we always look at that. And then obviously in this environment right now, there's a lot of things that have been, you know, unexpected, right? Freight is really high. We believe that's going to be temporary versus wages, I think, are going to continue to have some additional upward movement. So we got to figure out how to balance that. But, you know, we're trying to figure out what is the pricing we want to take to cover things that are permanent versus the things that are temporary, and then balance that with, you know, we have tremendous growth in front of us. So we want to make sure we're leveraging the growth to offset some of these costs too. Because at the end of the day, it comes back to, I want people feeling great about the chicken burrito that they buy from us. You know, I want them always saying, wow, I got a lot more for my money than any place else when it comes to picking a great meal.
Hey, if we may, just one more question on prices, Brian. I mean, I think you guys raised prices, menu prices, by as much as 4% earlier in the year. So if we think about what you might raise prices by, do you have a number that's kind of being talked about at the company that you guys are just bouncing around?
You know, I think we've been pretty consistent. We usually take about 2-3%. And, you know, we take a look at, as I mentioned, all those other variables to help us inform what that should look like. You know, whether or not it's going to be necessary to go beyond that, that's what we're waiting to try and understand. So, you know, the good news is we've got the strength of, you know, a really powerful brand with, I think, excellent results that gives us the flexibility on the timing of how we phase in pricing if we need to go beyond the 2-3% that we've taken historically.
One of the challenges that many companies like yours are facing right now is labor. We talk about it so much at Bloomberg, and our audience is really familiar with the challenges that companies are facing. How is staffing right now? What percent are you staffed if you think about open positions that you have at restaurants throughout the country?
Yeah, we're pretty fortunate. You know, back in, I guess it was like March, April, earlier this year, staffing was really challenging. You know, it kind of was one of those scenarios where as our dining rooms reopened, consumers became much more mobile, our demand just took off, and you know, we were caught behind staffing our restaurants, and it took us a while to get caught up. You know, we still have, you know, a couple hundred restaurants where, you know, we're challenged with the staffing. The good news is, though, it's much more across the country. You know, it's a couple restaurants in a region here or there. And we're being very, you know, surgical on how do we ensure that restaurant gets the staffing necessary to be successful. But it's a tough environment, make no mistake. And I kind of come back to where we started earlier. It's like the way we recruit is we talk about the strength of the brand. We talk about the growth opportunities. And then obviously this is what the proposition looks like when you get started with us, you know, from wages to benefits to, you know, being a part of a great team. So it's a tough environment, no doubt.
Are you at all worried, Brian, about workers trying to unionize in this environment? I mean, it does feel like as they get, you know, hourly gains, there feels like the worker is feeling empowered at this point. Is that at all on your mind?
You know, look, what I want to make sure is we're giving our employees a great experience. And my belief is Chipotle is a place that gives employees tremendous personal growth as well as, you know, business growth. And you know, there aren't many places where you can join an organization as a crew member and in a couple years find yourself running a multi-million dollar restaurant with a team of 30 to 35 employees. But what I think what also gets people excited is, and then there's a path to being a leader of multiple units, right? Where you get above the store and now you're overseeing 7-8 restaurants. And you know, the next level is our team director where you're overseeing 40-50 restaurants. The fact that we're gonna go build 3,000 or more restaurants, the growth for you professionally, it's just tremendous. And then we want to make sure we're providing everything we can so that personally you're growing. You know, we have tuition reimbursement, debt-free right. degrees, mental health benefits. But, you know, it's I think when you give people a great experience at the job, they're delighted to be a part of it. And that's our mission is I want people feeling great about working at Chipotle so that, you know, frankly, when they tell people where they work, they do it with a lot of pride.
Yeah, and you can definitely feel it. And I've seen it firsthand where you guys work with people to move them through and up the chain in terms of responsibility. Hey, one thing we've got to ask you, I know we've talked about this before. You and I were together just as everything was shutting down, you know, thinking about protocols and what it all meant. How do you plan to handle that vaccine mandate that we're starting to see for large employers for your restaurant, especially since you don't franchise? How do you do that? What's the plan?
Yeah, well, obviously, we're still waiting for all the details to come from OSHA on what that looks like. But yeah, you touched on it. We have close to 100,000 employees. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is going to be a logistical challenge. But nonetheless, we've got a great team that leads our well-being and health program. And they've done a phenomenal job through COVID. I'm confident we'll figure out how to navigate, you know, meeting or complying with this new OSHA requirement around, you know, vaccinations or getting a COVID test, a negative COVID test in order to work. You know, I'm hopeful that, you know, the feedback has gotten back to the folks that are making the policy on this so that yeah. It is something that's executable. Because, you know, I'd rather have a program that we can comply and actually make progress
right.
versus a program that sends us backwards.
You're not doing testing. You're not doing testing yet, are you?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay, we were curious about that. We should talk about digital because we know that's a big thing.
Yeah, we saw some growth year over year when it comes to digital ordering. I'm wondering what you think is going to happen when it comes to the goals that you have for digital ordering. Like, what do you want to see in terms of digital versus in-store?
Yeah, you know, look, this was a really exciting quarter for us because, you know, it was record sales when it comes to digital. But our dining rooms did over $1.1 billion in sales. So, you know, our $2 billion quarter was really, you know, call it $800 or $900 million of digital and over $1 billion of being in the dining room. And, you know, we've always thought these businesses are unique occasions. And I think we're demonstrating that. So, you know, right now we're settling in kind of 40% of the business. But, you know, the absolute dollars is really what we're focused on because we want to continue to grow that digital business while we grow our dining rooms. And it'll be part of the puzzle for how we get our average unit volumes to go above 3 million is continuing to drive those two businesses, which to date definitely appear to be different occasions and therefore very complementary.
All right. So we know smoked brisket is a limited run. We hear it's going to even end even sooner, Brian, because it's been so popular. So what's the next thing?
Yeah.
You guys are experimenting with plant-based items. What's the next thing that we can maybe look forward to?
Yeah, well, the next exciting menu item is this plant-based chorizo. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had it in test in a couple markets. I, you know, had the ability to go out and visit a few of these markets, and I'll tell you what, it just tastes amazing. I'll give you a pro tip right now. Like, plant-based chorizo with some white rice and queso and a taco, it's tough to beat. So, you know, it makes you feel really good about eating plant-based. That much I can tell you. So, yeah, we're excited about that. We've got a great culinary team. They're working on a lot of other ideas down the road. The idea is we always want to be listening to what consumers are asking us to provide, and then also leading consumers' palates. And I think we did a pretty good job this year demonstrating that, right? Like we did cauliflower rice, which was leading consumer palates. The quesadilla digitally was listening to consumers' requests. And then the smoked brisket, I think, was just a kind of a culinary plus-up. So, you know, the sauce those guys created around our brisket is just fabulous. And, you know, the meat's terrific. So I'm loving kind of the cadence that we've got. Our culinary team does a fabulous job,
right. And
our operators do a great job of executing.
All I'm going to say is I'm really hungry, and with the chorizo, you forgot the margarita. That's the only thing that you left out. Hey, listen, Brian. I know, we'll work on that. Hey, be well.
Exactly.
Be well. It was always good to check in with you. We really appreciate it. Brian Nickel, of course, Chairman and CEO of Chipotle Mexican Grill, joining us there from Newport Beach, California.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
In our weekly crypto segment, putting the spotlight back on the documentary, The Bitcoin Dilemma, having its world premiere as we speak. Technology futurist, documentarian, and author Ian Khan is the individual behind it. He is back with us here on Bloomberg Business Week. And Tim, he's in Iraq.
He is. Ian, it's so great to have you back on the show with us. First, give us an update on why you're in Iraq and what you're doing there.
So Iraq is an emerging market for me. I'm just consulting here and, you know, helping the government figure out the future trends. So just a bit of work and, a day off, actually.
Well, how is the government thinking about this technology, and how should governments be thinking about this technology, in your opinion?
I think governments have the biggest responsibility of looking at future trends and things that shape tomorrow. I mean, look at crypto. It is such an important thing that plays a big part in governance, whether you're a government in North America, Latin America, Middle East, it doesn't matter. Governments have to take cryptocurrency seriously as an example. You have to take emerging technologies very seriously and know what can shape the future of your country.
What are the questions that they're having over cryptocurrencies? And I think it's an interesting week to be having, at least here for the United States, because we saw, I feel like, crypto take a big step forward as a result of a Bitcoin futures ETF having its debut this week. It does feel like the regulatory front is slowly, increasingly jumping on board, certainly here in the U.S. What are the questions, the smart questions that bankers are having, central bankers?
So you'll be surprised to hear that, and you mentioned that the documentary launched in the Middle East. So it launched in Dubai at an event with 100,000 people attending. And that's groundbreaking. And a huge part of that conference was cryptocurrency, blockchain technology, and all of the related items, you know, EFTs and NFTs and so on, even the Meta. The biggest question right now is what is happening in terms of regulations? What is regulated? What is not regulated? Where is stability? But there's definitely not, I wouldn't say too much hype, but there's a lot of interest, both from the private sector as well as the government sector, in anything related to blockchain, cryptocurrency, NFTs, and so on.
I want to make sure I got this number right. How many people did you say attended?
100,000 people.
100,000 people attended the screening of this.
That's a lot.
What does that tell you?
No, attended the event, the conference,
right,
at which my documentary screened. Yes.
Okay.
But 100,000 people did not attend my documentary screening.
Well,
that would have been great.
It still does. That would be great. It still does. It still does speak, though, to the appeal that cryptocurrency is having right now around the world. Hey, I'm wondering, because you consult with governments all over and because you look at this so closely, give us an example of a country that's just doing this really well.
You look at the government of, different governments. And I know El Salvador has been in the news quite a bit with their Bitcoin adoption. And I feel they still have a long way to go before you can truly call it an amazing use case and a big success. I'm starting off on the a little bit of a downer. So if it's any government today, there isn't a use case where they've fully adopted crypto or they're moving fast towards it. Government of Dubai definitely has a blockchain side to it. They have a blockchain initiative. The United Arab Emirates, where I was just now a couple of days ago, they have a federal blockchain strategy, which is hard to come by in some other places. The Netherlands has a Dutch blockchain coalition. Singapore has something similar. So many governments across the world are focusing on blockchain, definitely, because it's much more than just cryptocurrencies, which are created essentially on blockchain. I wish there was a use case that had solved it all, but there isn't yet.
Well, you know, when you talk about hype, what is the hype? I mean, we are all still trying to figure out what it is, and, you know, if there are futures, what is it? What is the underlying asset that you're actually buying? I mean, there's so many questions out there. What do you see, if you have to whittle it down to what is really the hype in your view, or certainly from the experts that you talk to for your documentary?
And that's a great question. The hype essentially is overexpecting from any new technology, in my opinion. So if it's blockchain, then blockchain will solve every problem that we have. So let's take this piece of technology and find a problem, which is the wrong way of solving problems. Another hype is cryptocurrencies are the future. Let's all invest in cryptocurrencies right now and Bitcoin, because the price is always going to go up and it's going to be beautiful tomorrow. All those are hyped up statements. I think there's a realism that we need to deal with. Cryptocurrencies are unregulated. They need stability. They need support. They need a lot of things before we can say, hey, this asset class is stable, and yes, it's a real something real that's happening. And that's all. A little bit of that has happened just now with the new ETFs created. I think hype is just overblowing things out of proportion, not necessarily just trusting something that is something good, but thinking that this is the best thing ever.
Are you concerned, Ian, about volatility in the prices of cryptocurrencies pushing people away from interest, people saying, wait a second, if this thing moves so quickly and so much, then I don't want to touch it, and I'm kind of scared of it?
I'm actually concerned for people who are not listening to that, and they're still investing in cryptocurrencies thinking they're going to triple, quadruple their money. There's many people who are doing that right now, and those are the people I'm concerned for. I'm very confident that eventually, you know, a few years from now, a decade from now, cryptocurrency, what have you, in that entire ecosystem will be stable and all be good. But I think we have to tread carefully and not dump all our 401ks into it, not put all our investments into it, because the volatility is okay for large institutional investors, because they can play around with it. but not for people who are just testing this out. So a lot of caution.
Hey, Ian, just got about 35 seconds left here. Can you look into your crystal ball and say, okay, Bitcoin is going to replace X in the future, or you know, something that we count on today, but it will replace it? Is there something in your mind that makes sense above and beyond?
As an asset class that we invest in and it brings good valuation back, I think Bitcoin may not replace anything, but it definitely is on the way up to doing that because of its limited supply. Also, NFTs are going to rise. I think they're going to be very big in the next couple of years. So these two things I really bank on for now.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Yeah, so many questions. As you say, you see a lot of hype, but a lot of it is covered in that new documentary, The Bitcoin Dilemma. Ian Khan is behind it, technology futurist, documentarian, author, joining us on this Friday on the phone from Iraq. This is Bloomberg.
I'm driving in my car.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no. This is not a toy.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
Keep driving crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Yes, indeed, we're going to count you down to the close, but as we do, we just want to mention a headline crossing the Bloomberg terminal, and I do see Bristol-Myers Squibb expressing interest in acquiring rival biopharmaceutical company Aurinia Pharmaceuticals. This is according to People in the Know. Quick check on Aurinia Pharmaceuticals as the target, and it is definitely spiking. It is now up 10.6%. So straight up on that news, no surprise there. New York-based company recently approached Aurinia about a deal, said the people who has not to be identified because the matter is in public. No final decision has been made, and Bristol-Myers could opt against any potential deal, they said.
Yeah, another big scoop by our deals reporter, Ed Hammond. Check it out at the Bloomberg terminal.
M&A continues. It's going to be a record year, folks, for M&A. We're on track for that. All right, let's get into it, and let's see what our next guest has to say about the market environment, what's on the mind of investors, I should say. Rebecca Corbin, founder and chief executive officer at Corbin Advisors. She joins us back with us on the phone from Farmington, Connecticut. Hey, Rebecca, good to have you here. When I see M&A deals, to me, it says there's optimism in the market and companies have money to put to work. I should point out Aurinia, too, by the way, folks, is halted because of the volatility and that big move up. So triggering some trading stops there. You guys, you check what's on the minds of investors. What are you hearing?
Well, good afternoon, Carol and Tim. Yeah. Happy Friday. Thank you for having me back. You know, M&A is a very interesting topic right now. Like you said, it's been a record year. Lots of records being set. I don't know if that gives anybody cause. Feels a little peaky to me.
Okay.
I
just want to stop you there because that's something I think about a lot. What these superlatives mean about the economic cycle and where you think we are.
Well, I'm not sure that we are in any economic cycle. I think we're in a super cycle that is in orbit around COVID. And, you know, going back to the vacuum that happened in April 2020 when, like a tsunami, the water just receded and the beach was exposed, that was a lack of demand, to that prophecy coming to fruition in the second quarter of 2020, everybody actually sighing a sigh of relief because it was better than expected, even though companies were down, you know, 30-40%. To fast forward to, you know, over the summer and into this year with the massive amount of CapEx that's been plowed into the world globally, and now we're starting to see that massive demand, and clearly the supply chain can't handle it, coupled with other issues such as weather and port congestion, et cetera. So, you know, I'm not going to say that we're in a normal economic cycle. We're in the cycle of what is going on with COVID, and that still has to play out. But I will tell you that there is a confluence of events that are happening where there is now a shift. After several quarters of building optimism and really strong results where a number of companies were beating and raising unprecedentedly, raising guidance in Q1, unprecedentedly raising guidance in Q2 to where we are today. This is the first quarter that we are seeing supply chain disruption and cost inflation, which I will remind you, we've been identifying as an issue since fourth quarter 20, coming home to roost and having material impact on results. A lot of carcasses going to be on the road this quarter and next.
Well, I see what you're saying, But is it maybe difficult for another quarter, but ultimately manageable as supply chains right themselves? Because it does seem like, you know, Jay Powell making some comments, he said the global supply chain will resume functioning over time. It's a very uneven recovery. Risks tilted clearly to bottlenecks and higher inflation. But they do feel like their policy is in good place. I mean, we still see some dislocations, no doubt about it, just to look at the labor market. We just talked to the Chipotle CEO. But nonetheless, you know, people are buying lots of stuff, and we are still meeting a lot of demand.
The supply chain, I believe, based on channel checks, is underappreciated in terms of the impact that we will see.
Meaning what?
Companies, yeah. In terms of not truly understanding the second, third, fourth derivative of supply chain dislocation and how globally interconnected we are. And while there is very, very strong demand, that is, you know, earnings calls for the past three quarters, including this quarter, have talked about strong demand, strong growth, record levels. That's true, and they're seeing that. However, these issues are very significant, and some of these are not transitory. You know, labor inflation is not transitory. It is very difficult when you have wages up 17%, in some cases 20%, to actually walk that back down. What has to happen for wages to reset at pre-pandemic levels, if you will, or levels that are not inflated at this rate? We have to go through a layoff, period. And so, you know, and I'm not suggesting we will go through that, but clearly labor inflation is not transitory and you cannot take that away. And right now the employee is in the command seat because of the labor shortage and because of the demand, and companies are paying these levels. But when demand starts to decelerate, and it will have to do that, we will see, you know, that scenario play out. So I just, you know, the supply chain scenario is one, but that is setting kind of a fuse for other things to happen in order for, you know, the environment that we're in to right itself, because the pendulum just swung, you know, one way too far and the other way too far, and we're trying to get back to center.
Okay, so how do you play an environment like this, the one that you describe? Where are you putting money?
Well, I can tell you where investors are putting money. They're putting money in pure plays because they're very easy to understand. They're putting money in North America. Out of all of the regions, North America is the biggest bet. And interestingly, they're putting money in small caps. So, you know, those are three. The other, which I think is very interesting, and again, I love to read the tea leaves of our research. And, you know, this quarter we saw a tremendous shift in sentiment. The top three investment thematic is cost-cutting initiatives. When we start to see companies announcing cost-cutting initiatives, that's a sign. That is a sign of strain on the organization, and because companies have been spending hand over foot with regard to reinvesting in their business, which is why we're in this type of environment. Companies were sitting on boatloads of free cash flow in the second quarter and third quarter of 2020. What did they do? They plowed it all into the market. And so they created this demand for services and goods. Consumers felt great about it as well, because there was this exuberance around, you know, summertime and getting through COVID, et cetera. And, you know, so we're watching to see what happens with reinvestment strategies.
All right. So,
and you talked about M&A, and M&A is at a record pace.
Right.
You know, and investors, what was shocking to me, quite frankly, having tracked investor sentiment for the past 20 years, after seeing reinvestment at such high levels quarter over quarter for three consecutive quarters, this quarter was the first time that debt paydown came into focus as the number one preference in our inside the buy side earnings primer survey, which we published last week.
Right.
And not only that, but the level of comfort with debt levels went down. So we saw a big, sharp increase in net debt to EBITDA at around one time.
All right.
This is very, very conservative.
Yeah, that certainly does speak to a conservative action. Hey, Rebecca, we've got to run. Rebecca Corbin, founder and CEO at Corbin Advisors, with us on the phone from Farmington, Connecticut.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.